This week's Decision Wisconsin podcast is a good one. I've talked to him on the show before. This is Steve Scavitti, host of WTMJ Now on WTMJ. Scott Klug, former Wisconsin congressman, somebody who's really, really looking at politics in a different way. I just had him on the show recently. We talked about a piece he did for the Wisconsin State Journal on ticket splitting. We may get to that. But Congressman, I want to start with this. This is a big, big year in politics, 2024. I've made this case before. Often we say this is the craziest year we've ever seen in presidential politics. As somebody who served as a congressman, what do you think about that claim?
I think you're right. I mean, I think it's just what's happened is we seem to gather more and more closely in the PAC tribal groups that really can't talk to the other side. It used to be that, you know, I could get in policy arguments with Democrats I served with in the House, and, you know, 2 hours later you'd find us playing pickup basketball in one of the House gyms. In this way, the closest way to buy yourself political extinction is to actually vote across the aisle, and you get primaried and you get kicked out. And I don't think that's the way politics was meant to be, right? Democracy is always about trying to reach some kind of compromise to solve solutions. And, you know, as we were talking earlier, this latest fight over the immigration battle, I meant 20 years ago, George Bush was trying to get it done, and it got blocked in the Senate by the Democrats. And now Biden's trying to get it done, and it's getting blocked in the House by the Republicans. You know, I'm a small government Republican, a libertarian. Not a big fan of the government. You know, but the trains have to move on time, and, you know, you've got to be able to give the U.S. government the financing to keep the clocks running. So it's, I think you're right. It's the most frustrating time I've seen. And you know who's really frustrated, Steve? There's about 45% of this country that self-defines themselves as centrists, and they can't figure out what the hell's going on. I mean, you know, the Republicans are running around trying to take middle school books off the shelf, and the Democrats are trying to take the stove out of your kitchen. It's like, who elected these people? And that's the way I feel.
I often call it performative politics, and I think that's right, because it's more acting like an elected official than actually doing the work of an elected official. And you mentioned immigration and border policy. We actually have a bipartisan effort in the Senate that's going to be blown up because a Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, is listening apparently to a former President Donald Trump who says, this is bad for me. I don't want any solution, any improvement on these issues because it doesn't help me in my reelection campaign. The Trump effect. Talk about that.
Well, and it's very real. I mean, and that plays both ways. I mean, again, if you look in 2002, when the Bush immigration plan got spiked, it got spiked by the Democrats because they had their eyes on the presidential election 2 years later. You know, if you run for office, you know, I guess I'm a little old fashioned here. I'd like to think you run for office, you run to be a mayor like you did, in order to get things accomplished. And that doesn't mean you don't hang to your principles, but you're trying to solve real world problems. And if all the point is to just keep getting reelected and reelected and reelected without doing anything, you're going to get what you see today in American politics. Somewhere north of 45% of Americans now self-define as independents. That's a growing trend. It's the largest registration in Nevada, for example, is independents, more than Republicans and Democrats combined. So the American public are going to have their say about this. It may not be this election cycle, but I think we've seen, you know, the deterioration of trust that Americans have in a lot of institutions. And I think political parties are right at the top of that list. Now, I don't think there's going to be a viable third-party candidate this time out for president, but I think in the not-too-distant future, if we could find somebody that's got some sense of charisma, it could shake the two political parties to their core.
If the two sides don't change anything, I think that's defined as a stalemate. But within any stalemate, at some point the dam breaks. What would that political equivalent be to break this dam and to sort of reverse the trends we've seen in politics in America?
I'm not much of a prognosticator. I can be on football games and basketball games, but in politics, I think it's hard to say. You know, here's the weird thing about it. For your listeners of a certain vintage, they'll appreciate this. George Bush grew up in Kennebunkport, Maine, affluent city, and, you know, for years, New England was heavily Republican. Today, George Bush Sr. could not get elected in Maine, period, end of discussion. Biden won it handily. Bill Clinton won, putting together a coalition of largely southern states And he made a lot about his small hometown of Hope, Arkansas. Today, Bill Clinton wouldn't just lose Arkansas. He'd get blottoed in Arkansas. And so it's a little hard to figure out where this goes 4 years from now, because pieces in American politics are always moving around. You know, when I was a kid and I was in high school, I went to Marquette High in Milwaukee, and when sad losers that we were without dates on Friday night, I ended up with a bunch of buddies, pizza and a Risk game on my family's dining room table. And in Risk, you know, you'd fight over these things, and you'd want Europe and I'd want Africa, and then we'd be battling over Mexico or whatever it is. And that's sort of the map of the U.S. politics. It's hard to really say what it's going to look like in the next presidential elections, because things shift. I mean, you have a political party, and, you know, let's take the Democrats, for example. So the Democrats become more highly educated, more progressive, more coastal. And as that trend happens, some of the folks of the existing Democratic coalition, blue-collar Hispanic workers, say, wait a minute, this is not who I am. I mean, I'm Catholic. Family's important to me. I don't understand all this woke stuff. And as you see now, working-class Hispanics are shifting to the Republicans. Then meanwhile, you see suburban voters sitting out in suburban Milwaukee looking at Donald Trump going, wait a minute, this isn't what I signed up for. I mean, what I wanted was smaller government, less taxes, a less intrusive government. And now we suddenly got these culture wars going on. And I, you know, is this really the best use of our time to fight about elementary school books or, you know, a whole assortment of issues? And they move to the Democratic Party. And so it's really hard to predict the political future, because it just keeps moving. And anybody who says they'll be able to tell you how Nebraska or Idaho or Florida is going to vote 4 years from now is crazy. Look at Georgia. Sorry, I'm rambling on here. But before 2000, Georgia was a predictably conservative Democratic state. A Republican governor gets elected. The legislature assumes followed. And by the middle of, you know, in 2004, it's now solidly crazy red Republican. You go to where we are today in Georgia, it's the ultimate purple state. In fact, if you look, there's an argument to say that the next presidential election will really only depend on seven states. And to make this even crazier, it probably only depends on a grand total of about 80 congressional districts across those seven states that'll determine who the next president will be. And they're in a predictable list, right? It's Georgia, it's Wisconsin, it's New Hampshire. You know, stop me. It's Nevada. It's Arizona. It's the same list you see year after year after year, because that's where the most definitive swing voters and ticket splitters are at the moment.
It is amazing. You know, 150 million votes cast traditionally, and we may have this election again decided by, you know, what'd you say, 100,000, 200,000 people?
Yeah, that's about what it'll be in each of the states if you add them up. I mean, the swings even, and I don't know these numbers, so some of your listeners may. But, you know, it wasn't more than a swing of 20,000 votes and 30,000 votes in sort of state by state that would swing Georgia, would have swung Wisconsin. And the same story is true for Hillary. You know, one of the interesting things about independent candidates running for president this time out, because there's a lot of buzz, is whether they'll really have an impact on it. You know, and Democrats have never forgiven Ralph Nader for running as an independent in Florida. Mm-hmm. Nader never got close to winning any states. The last independent candidate to win states running for president was George Wallace. Before him, it was Teddy Roosevelt. And while Ross Perot did very well at the ballot box by winning, I think he got 17 or 18% when it was all done, he never came close in a single state. So the challenge, I think, this time out is people look at independent candidates. I just don't really think they have the kind of traction, but they could serve a spoiler role. But now you look and you see that Kennedy wants to run as a Libertarian because he can't get on a number of states' ballots. And you see the same effect where No Labels, which was going to run a bipartisan ticket, is sort of falling apart as we speak. They're beating Democratic and Republican candidates are both sort of walking away from it. Larry Hogan, who was a very popular Republican governor and very Democratic Maryland, was supposed to be the VP pick, and Manchin was supposed to be the presidential pick, and now Manchin's dancing around. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. But one of the things to watch is not whether one of the independents can win a state, but whether one of the independents can cost one of the candidates a state or two.
I got to ask about Donald Trump. He is looking at some polling numbers today. He is now leading in polls in some of the states you were just talking about. And I'm going to ask it in a couple different ways. One, describe your view of what Donald Trump represents as a politician. And two, this is me asking a pointed question. How dangerous would a second Trump presidency be?
Well, okay, we can get the phones ringing if they could call in a podcast. Here's one of the great challenges for me, and one of the things we did in my podcast, Lost Middle, is we spent a lot of time talking to voters. And one of the things that really intrigued me about Iowa, and I talked to several folks about this, is why evangelicals stuck with Trump. Meant you would think if somebody's very religious and wants to follow the path of Jesus, you would want somebody you would emulate who had sort of those same virtues. Now, I'm not going to try to make the argument that Jimmy Carter was a great president, but at least you could figure out that Clinton had principles, or excuse me, Carter had principles.
Went to church every Sunday, and probably more than that.
Yeah, and you can make the same case, I think, for a number of folks. I mean, I think Reagan clearly had a sense of his North Star. But with Trump, it's hard to figure out who he is, right? If you look at his political history over the years, he's been everything. I mean, he's been a Republican and a Democrat and an independent, literally, like Mike Bloomberg, who did the same thing when he ran for mayor. So when you think about those evangelicals, I couldn't understand it until I talked to a couple of folks who were evangelicals, who were frustrated by the same issue I'm talking about. And essentially it came down to say, well, he's an SOB, but he's our SOB. And he'll get things done. And in order to get things done in Washington, like overturning Roe versus Wade, you need people who are tough and willing to pound on the table to get it done. I think that's what people like. And I also think, Steve, there's a big part of this country, and boy, I certainly get this, where, you know, the war's going on now because Taylor Swift is going to become a proxy for Biden. Well, stop me when, you know, how many Republicans are there in Hollywood? You can count them on one hand, and might not even take your whole hand. And I think a lot of people get tired with the cultural stuff. It's hard to open up the New York Times and not see three transgender stories every weekend. I'm not saying they don't deserve coverage, not that I don't am empathetic with the personal battles they have to go through, but it seems to be just absolutely consumed by a handful of social issues that most people don't think and worry about every day. So I think what's helping Trump is the sense there's a lot of people who feel like the elites, the folks in the coasts, you know, the Hollywood Academy, the universities, you know, the speech codes that are going on in university. I think a lot of people are just frustrated by that. And so Trump may be a jerk, but he's our jerk. He's the one who's going to punch those guys in the nose. Now, what happens in the second presidency? I'll have to say something in defense of Trump in that his campaign this time out is much more disciplined, much more orderly. They kept him out of the debates. They kept his focus much more narrowly on the issues. You know, for all those eruptions that have happened in recent weeks, it's tend to be really only focused on Haley after the New Hampshire primary, and it's only really been focused mostly on his court battles. It's not been stuff. And so he's not been at rallies creating problems for themselves. So I think that's going to say his campaign is going to be much more disciplined moving the next 11 months forward. I also think that there's some hope that his cabinet and the people around him will be much more disciplined next time out. So you can sort of check the first box that they've managed to accomplish that and keep them, you know, much more like bowling with bumper lanes to keep them out of trouble. It'll be interesting to see if they can, you know, if they can find somebody to run the Justice Department and serve as the U.S. Secretary of State. And when they go there, if Trump will trust their judgment or if he'll be what he was like in his first term, which was lurching left to right, up and down every other day.
You can't talk about Donald Trump without talking about the legal problems he's facing, whether that's civil or criminal. We certainly have cases in Georgia, New York, and Florida, documents case, election interference. How much of that reality, political, legal reality, will impact the politics of 2024 before the election or leading up to it?
Well, I think clearly there's a chunk of folks who now say they're going to vote for Trump that won't vote for him if he's convicted of a felony. I think if he's convicted of a felony, there get to be issues that are going to have to be sorted out through the legal system, right? Can somebody with a felony actually be elected president? Is he barred from running? If he's convicted for crimes that not necessarily say insurrection, but essentially say things like insurrection, will that make him even possible to be sworn in? And then the gazillion billion-dollar question is, if Trump gets elected, can he pardon himself? So the Supreme Court's going to have a very important, very bizarre docket that I don't think anybody could project going forward. So I think the legal troubles are real, although, honest to God, I meant what a gift for Trump and all the rest of the defendants in the Georgia case, that I think it's likely this DA is going to have to recuse herself. I think her paramour, as alleged by his soon-to-be ex-wife, is going to get fired from his job prosecuting the case. Then if that happens, my understanding, it has to go to the state attorney general's office and to whatever the adjudicating body is that would intervene if they had to fire a prosecuting attorney in another case. And then who are they going to pick to prosecute this case? So in some ways, that was the most threatening case to Trump, right? It's the most serious charges. Racketeering, in some ways, is complicated it is with 30 defendants. If they're all involved in a conspiracy, this is my jailhouse lawyering, although I work for Foley and Lardner. This is me sort of off-the-cuff remarks from having watched too many episodes of Law and Order and covering trials. I think you only need two overt acts to convict everybody in the racketeering conspiracy, and that's not very hard to do when you've already got six or seven defendants who've already pled guilty. Georgia was the biggest threat to him, but now I think the whole case may fall apart. I think in many ways the document case is the easiest to prove because that's really not very complicated. You're supposed to turn these things back in. You said you turned them back in. You didn't do it. Here they were. You're caught on tape telling people to move boxes and hide documents. I mean, I think you and I could prosecute that even though we didn't spend 2 days in Moscow.
Yeah, I think that's actually the one that makes the most sense and actually could have a recourse for the former president before November. Last thing for you. Do you think, like we saw in Bush versus Gore in 2000, that the final arbiter of all of this is the U.S. Supreme Court?
It could be, right? So they can stop and start stuff. I don't think the case against banning Trump being able to be on the ballot will stand, right? Because he was not convicted of insurrection. And you can sort of make the case, well, that's what it was, but he wasn't convicted of that. So I don't think any of those are going to have any legs. And it's been interesting in a lot of Democratic states, for example, Michigan, their Supreme Court turned it down and said, no, he has the right to be on the ballot. But I think ultimately the question about pardoning him and then about there are some, I think, presidential
immunity
about
yep.
what the yeah, immunity, what the, well, not only immunity itself, yeah, but what the president can do while he's in office and what's official acts. So if you said, well, I'm the president and I think that some of these states' counts weren't accurate, that's probably part of what you should ask as a president, right? On the other hand, trying to swear in bizarre election ballot crowds, what's the word I'm looking for here, with delegates in order to overturn the elections, I think that's a bridge too far. But the courts are going to have to figure that out. And you're right, that's where it's going to end up, is in the Supreme Court. They're going to have a very busy, very complicated, very controversial summer.
It will be an interesting year in politics. Scott Klug, former Wisconsin congressman, always great to talk to you.
Well, and one quick plug, it's lostinthemiddle.com. There's 8 episodes. We've got another 6 to go, and everything from ticket splitting, the independent runs for president, and I hope your listeners will give it a listen. You can find it any place you find podcasts or on the website.
From one podcast to another, love it.